We talk a lot about the Bible on this podcast, but if you're someone who hasn't read the Bible for yourself before, or if you're someone who wants to go deeper, it can be really helpful to have a Bible study guide to follow. Yarrow Bible Studies can help you grow in your relationship with God and find answers to the questions that are on your mind. Yarrow Studies are very visually inviting, and they give you space for reflection at the same time as guiding you through the Bible so you can know what it says and what it means for your actual life. No matter where you're coming from or what season of life you're in, Yarrow is the Bible study guide that will help you unearth the truth of Scripture so it can take root in your heart and inspire you to go deeper in your relationship with God. Yarrow offers beautifully designed inductive Bible studies and a free digital app. If you're looking for a place to start with Yarrow Studies, why not grab a copy of their first study, Known, which is all about identity in Christ. You can shop at yarrow.org now and save 10% off with the code ConfrontingChristianity10. You're listening to Confronting Christianity, a podcast of Training the Church.
It seems as though within the composition of the Pentateuch, certain laws were actually designed and textualized to tell a story. And so thus what we're reading right now isn't a pure law book, so to speak, but a book that has laws and legislation in it. And the stakes are really high, and they're designed to be high and supposed to be high because it's trying to make a really big statement about who God is and what he essentially requires. In short, Leviticus doesn't necessarily see a problem with a priesthood as a thing per se, but it sees a problem with humans who are occupying it. And it's pointing to kind of something else that's needed.
I'm here with my friend Andrew Heil. Hey, Andrew, how's it going?
Going great. Thanks for having me.
You are welcome. For those who do not know Andrew, he holds a master's degree from Harvard Divinity School. He's currently working on a PhD in Harvard's Department of Near Eastern Languages and Civilizations, where he's studying Hebrew Bible and Semitic languages. And his research centers, I'm told, on the composition, writing conventions, and scribal epistemologies behind ritual text production in ancient Israel. So that sounds like a really kind of fun, like Friday night drinks party conversational starter, Andrew.
Yes, totally. Yeah, very. It's very clear, very understandable. Yeah, I mean, essentially what that's trying to get at, the simplest terms possible, is just the way in which ritual stuff, so think sacrifices, think cleansing ritual, think purification ritual, the way that all of this was designed textually, not just in a reality in history, but how do we understand this as texts? And there's a difference between the two things.
Oh, interesting. We'll maybe get more into that later in the conversation. I've lured Andrew here to talk about Leviticus, but Andrew is a friend from church, and I texted his wife earlier today to ask for embarrassing questions I could ask Andrew as we start this conversation. But rather than all the incredibly embarrassing things that she highlighted, I'm going to ask him about the correct pronunciation of the word, which Americans would spell Zebra. How would you say that, Andrew?
Zebra. So how I would pronounce that is zebra. But how would you pronounce it?
Well, do you know, this is funny. So the reason that I'm asking Andrew this is because you were raised at least part of your childhood in South Africa. Is that right?
Yeah. Born there, lived there till I was 15, moved to the States.
Yeah. So I, coming from the UK, also would say zebra. But my three American children say zebra. And it's actually, I play a game with my son, who's five, where he's in the bath and I pick bath toys that are various animals. And I tell him I could describe the toy and he has to guess what it is. And then I throw it into the bath. And one of the animals is a zebra. And it always just like, there's a little piece of my heart that always just dies when he guesses the answer is zebra. It's just so wrong.
So wrong. I remember moving to the States during high school. And I forget what the exact context was, but I said the word zebra and my whole class laughed.
Oh, no.
And thus prompting the conversation, why do some say zebra, some say zebra? And I guess how that dialogue sort of ended, I said, listen, we're the ones who have them. I don't think you get to name them. And thus Zebra.
That is a brilliant riposte and one that I cannot use as a Brit, but I will sort of appropriate it. And actually, you know, this is not as wildly far from the conversation that I really want to have with you today as it might be, because the reality is, you know, both you and I grew up on different continents and moved to the United States of America at some point in our lives when we were already kind of functional, if not quite adults in your case, you know, people who had a lot of history, a lot of thinking, a lot of things that we were used to where we were from. And we're showing up in a new place where things are just done differently. And I think the reality is any of us in the year of our Lord 2023 who are opening the Bible and reading any part of the Bible, there's an extent to which we are entering as immigrants, sort of coming into a foreign land, because even when it comes to the New Testament, we are not first century Jews or first century folks in the Greco-Roman Empire. We don't have a lot of the cultural context at our fingertips. There are things that we don't sort of understand intuitively just because we weren't raised in the context that the original audiences for both the Old and New Testament texts were raised in. And I think that's probably especially true when it comes to the Old Testament, and perhaps even especially true when it comes to the book of Leviticus, which I know is a special area of interest for you, Andrew. In fact, I think it's probably fair to say that many people who start reading the Bible from the beginning, you know, they get through Genesis just fine, you know, a lot of stuff, but they can follow. They get through Exodus, and then Leviticus, it tends to be where people get really stuck and perhaps even give up. So give us a sense, Andrew, you know, first, where does Leviticus fit in to those opening books of the Bible, sometimes called the Pentateuch or the Torah, the first sort of five books, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. What's Leviticus doing there?
Yeah, no, that's an excellent question. No, and a teacher of mine would refer to Leviticus as the so-called Bermuda Triangle of Bible reading plans. Hmm. You know, you get through Genesis, there's fun, exciting stories. Things are just crazy. You never know what to expect in the next chapter. Likewise, as we enter Exodus, similar things. There's a grand exodus of Israel out of Egypt, Pharaoh defeated, drowned in the sea. They come out singing songs. And then you come to a mountain and everything just seems to change for a long period of time. So people, you know, Bible reading plans die out. But I think one of the first things that's important in any sort of discussion on Leviticus to kind of cover up front is that Leviticus itself does not exist in a vacuum. This text has been designed textually to relate to previous books that come before it, Exodus and Genesis, and books that will come after it, Numbers and the book of Deuteronomy. And so, I mean, just generally, many people, whether you grow up a part of any sort of religious tradition or not, are generally familiar with a bunch of these stories within the Pentateuch. And by Pentateuch, we just mean the five books of Moses, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. Many people are familiar with lots of these stories individually. People could tell you about the creation story. They could tell you about Noah and the flood. They could tell you about Joseph and Moses and the Exodus. And we're often taught these stories episodically, or just as anthologies, just a collection of stories that have been brought together in a single book. Sometimes that way of reading can be helpful, but sometimes it can distract from a much bigger reality that these stories were actually textualized to be understood together. Mm. That is the creation story. The Pentateuch doesn't just have a creation story and a flood story. It has a flood story that mimics the language of the creation story. Mm. And bringing those two texts in conversation with one another. Now it's something different than just a creation story and something different than just a flood story. But it's a text and it's a composition. So I guess another helpful example here would be our introduction to the person of Abram, or who will later become Abraham in Genesis 12. We're told at the start of that chapter that there's a famine in the land, you know, a concept that we're familiar with in other stories that the Bible tells. It starts off with a famine in the land. And where does Abram go? He goes down to Egypt. And when he's in Egypt, who does he meet? Oh, he meets the Pharaoh down in Egypt. And the Egyptian Pharaoh takes Abraham's wife because she's beautiful. And Abraham, it says, acquires tons of servants and livestock and all that stuff from the Egyptians. And then it says that God strikes Pharaoh's house with plagues, something that should sound very similar to other stories that we've heard within the story of the Exodus. And eventually Pharaoh says, take your wife and everything that you have and go. And the first verse of chapter 13 says, and Abraham went up out of Egypt. And so that whole story that we were just presented with is a story of Abraham mimicking the language, mimicking the design, mimicking even the very sequence of a story like the Exodus. So the point is, when we meet Abraham, we're not just reading a story about a little man that lived a long time ago. We're reading a story that's brought into discussion within a much bigger literary context that is up to the author to kind of deliver us their message of what this book is about and how it works.
Just to clarify, when you say Abraham mimicking Exodus, Abraham's first in Genesis and then Exodus, is it sort of, when we get to the stories in Exodus, we're meant to be thinking, oh, this is kind of reminding me of some of the things that happened with Abraham, that is kind of building, like stacking on top of those stories.
Just like stacking exactly. And it's an important question to ask, why? Why would it be doing something like that? Mm. And so one is just, this is the way they tell stories. How else would you tell a story about Egypt than going down to Egypt and getting hit with plagues and the like? But the important thing to note is that in that story in Exodus, God's plan essentially is to bring Israel up out of Egypt because of his promises to Abraham. Mm-hmm. So thus the story of the Exodus is fundamentally tied to the promises made to Abraham. Mm-hmm. It's not just that we have an Abraham story and an Exodus story, but what's happening within the early chapters of Exodus is directly correlated to the story of Abraham and the promises made to him there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we've got Genesis and Exodus, and I'm actually going to be talking with a friend about Exodus on another episode, which I'm excited about as well. But tell us then about Leviticus. So Leviticus kind of breaks the rhythm that we're used to from Genesis and Exodus of being a lot of, you know, primarily story, although we certainly get quite a bit of law in Exodus. But help us understand, what purpose is Leviticus fulfilling for us in this great revelation of who God is and how he relates to his people?
No, that's good. So the way the book, and again, we kind of have to orient it to the movement from Genesis to Exodus. And so you could think about it in terms of really what is happening in Leviticus. All chapters 1 through 27 are all happening within the frame of a mountain. It's all taking place in front of Mount Sinai. But even that, earlier in Exodus, later in the book of Exodus and earlier in the book of Numbers, this is all happening at Sinai. So if you were to think of the book of Moses or the Pentateuch as fitting within three panels, so to speak, three movements, movement one is like Genesis 1 all the way up to Exodus 18. Movement two is Exodus 19, where they come to the mountain, all the way to Numbers 10, when they leave the mountain. And Numbers 11 through the end of Deuteronomy is a variety of stories in the wilderness, and then as they're about to enter the land. But what that gives us is Exodus 19 through Numbers 10. We're talking 58 chapters is just taking place at this mountain. 27 chapters in Exodus, 27 in Leviticus, 10 chapters in Numbers. And within the narrative time, those 58 chapters are collectively taking, it's crazy, it just takes 1 year within 58 chapters. And this is in huge contrast to the way in which the book of Genesis telescopes history. It presents you thousands of years in just 11 chapters, and then it presents hundreds of years in just less chapters. And successively, the narrative slows down until it gets Israel in front of this mountain at the central sort of panel of the Pentateuch. And so the question of like Leviticus is standing center of that panel too. And so its story is really connected to, again, the promises made to the patriarchs, God's plan for restoration for the world, and how the covenant made with this community at Sinai is really going to play a big role into what the story is all about. And so in terms of its literary setting, or what is even happening within the book of Leviticus, it's presenting ritual legislation for the priests, for the people, all in orientation to God's dwelling with humanity. And this is the reason for the Exodus, that God brings Israel out of Egypt to his mountain, because he wants to dwell with them. And so they're brought to a mountain. They get kind of terrified and they get scared, and something kind of changes and shifts. And with this, we kind of get they're not going to be a kingdom of priests anymore, so to speak, but now they're going to be a kingdom with priests. And so because of this fear, we get essentially a bunch of legislation added. And the way in which this works is through the narrative itself. We see this again and again. So not only within Leviticus, but through the whole Sinai pericope, we get legislation, and then a breaking of that legislation that they just got, and then other legislation, and then breaking of that legislation that they just got.
Interesting.
And so Leviticus is kind of operating within this much bigger narrative scheme.
Two questions, Andrew. One, you use the word pericope. What does that mean?
So, yeah, I mean, pericope, let's just talk about, like, the movement of Exodus 19 through 10. Everything that's taking place, the narrative, because we're not just reading a story, right? As you pointed out, it's narrative that's been attached to legislation, but that are fundamentally connected. So we could otherwise call it a composition, a literary movement. It's not just story. It's not just legislation. It's those two things put together.
Got it. And question number two, I believe that you are, is it a resident tutor at Harvard? Is that your role?
Yes. Yeah. Resident.
Am I correct that I'm hearing some delightful Harvard musical noises in your background at the moment?
You might be. I have my headphones on, so I cannot hear anything, but you most likely are.
That's wonderful. Background noise from the Harvard students under your care. So back to Leviticus. So we're at the mountain with God's people as they are hearing more and more about how God wants to live with them and what it would look like for them to live as God's people. Is that fair to say?
Yeah.
I think one of the big themes that people will find if they do open up Leviticus and start to read is this idea of certain things being clean versus unclean. And we might intuitively think, okay, we understand what clean and unclean is. You know, when I tell my kids to wash their hands because they're dirty, they go from being unclean to being clean. We have this, you know, basic understanding there. But it seems like in Leviticus, these categories are meaning something a little bit different from just sort of clean and dirty, that they have some spiritual significance. But it's probably not going to be evident to the person as they first sit down and read Leviticus, like, what actually does this mean and what does it not mean? So I'd love you to give us a little bit of a steer on what are these categories of clean and unclean and how do they operate in this book?
Yeah. I mean, just like you stated, the stated purpose of the Exodus, bringing Israel out of Egypt, was to bring them to a mountain so that God could dwell with people. And again, that's kind of the hope of the prophets too, is that one day there's going to be a situation made that God can dwell with people again. So the word just dwell is shachan, and the word for tabernacle is just the noun formation of that verb, mishkan, the dwelling place. So what the tabernacle is, what it's designed to sort of represent textually within the Pentateuch, is just God's dwelling place with humanity. That there's a point now where heaven and earth meet, so to speak, in this tabernacle space. And so as such, the tabernacle is starting to sound a lot like the garden that the early chapters of Genesis kind of open with and talk about, a place where God walks around, a place where he dwells with people, and a place where people have life if they're obedient. Mm. So if you're obedient, you can keep this garden, just do what I say. And in the same way, I can dwell with you in this tabernacle if you keep these sorts of restrictions. Hmm. And so part of this has to do with the topic of clean and unclean.
Wait, just to be clear, Andrew, when you say the garden, you're talking about the Garden of Eden,
yes,
where God originally placed humanity, the sort of idyllic or Edenic place, as we might call it in Genesis, that when we hear about the tabernacle and later the temple, this is a sort of symbolic recreation of that special place. Is that a fair?
Yeah, that's fair. And I guess even just speaking on, like, location-wise, as a result of Genesis chapter 2 narrates the preparation of this garden place in Eden. And it talks about these four rivers, and it's always confused, like, why does the text just talk about, like, randomly these rivers? The place and location of these rivers and where it situates the land of Eden has clear ties to the promises made to Abraham in Genesis 15 about the land that he's going to possess. And so it maps then Abraham's promised land onto the Garden of Eden in terms of the same sort of spatial setting and location. Why this is important is because after the garden and after the curses that kind of take place in Genesis 3, humanity is kicked in a direction out of the garden, and that direction is east. Mm. They move east and east and east and east. After Cain kills Abel, they move east and east. And God calls Abram out of Ur of the Chaldeans, or Babylon, and he goes west to take the land again. And so what's important is that this Mishkan, this tabernacle, the place where God will dwell with humanity, these are legislation given to them right before they're about to enter back into the land. the land that was once lost, but the land that's going to be now restored. And the same kind of situation remains. If they can keep these commands, if they can keep this legislation, they will get to live with God in the land. But if not, they will be out of it. And so just on the question of, back to the question then of clean and unclean, these are not necessarily, these, the category of unclean and clean do not map totally on our conceptions of sinful and not sinful. And so these are, this is like a distinction that needs to be made. Just because someone is unclean doesn't mean that they're sinful. And just because someone is clean doesn't mean that they're unsinful. Clean and unclean are categories represented to kind of maintain the conditions by which God's holiness can dwell with people. But that doesn't, it doesn't map totally onto conceptions of, yes, sinful and not. So for example, if a man has an emission of semen or if a woman menstruates, those are normal things that naturally occur. And those are categories that marks people as unclean and need a purification. That's not a sin. It's just a design in which these are sort of restrictions put in place for God's holiness to dwell with people. While these sorts of things are natural, the idea is that God's holiness is something so apart from how humanity naturally exists in and of themselves, that certain conditions need to be put in place to foster God's presence with people.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. Tell me if this is a helpful analogy at all. It might not be. I'm just trying it out for the first time in real time here. Some people's houses, and ours is sort of semi like this. They kind of have a rule that when you come into the house, you take off your shoes. And it's not that wearing shoes is innately a bad thing. We kind of need shoes to get around the world. But coming into the house, it's actually appropriate to take your shoes off so that you're not bringing some things from outside and in. Are there any senses in which that's kind of a helpful analogy for thinking about, okay, how are God's people able to kind of come near to him? Well, there might be some things that they need to leave at the threshold, so to speak, a little bit like you might take your shoes off.
Yeah. There's this kind of sense that everything needs to be different for God to dwell with people. And that doesn't just, it's not just about sacrifice. It's not just about sin. It's everything is all consuming. Everything is all encompassing. These are, and the stakes are really high.
Yeah.
And they're designed to be high and supposed to be high.
Yeah.
Because it's trying to make a really big statement across tons of chapters. Why do we get tons of this? It's trying to make a big statement about who God is and what he essentially requires.
Ever since Jesus's female followers were the first to witness his resurrection, women have been sharing the message of Jesus with those who have never heard it. In his new book, 10 Women Who Changed the World, seminary president Daniel L. Akin tells the stories of 10 women in particular who were called by God to serve as missionaries all across the world. As I've studied missions and read missionary biographies over my lifetime, Akin writes, I've been amazed and inspired by the large number of women who left home, families, comfort and safety in obedience to Jesus and his command to go to the nations with his gospel. Their number is far greater than most realize. You can find out about a handful of these stories in 10 Women Who Changed the World, which is available wherever books are sold. Let's talk a little bit then about this, the sacrificial system, because a lot of the laws in Leviticus are laws that are sort of more specific to what the priests should be doing and the kinds of sacrifices that should be offered. So help us understand, you know, what was the sacrificial system about in its original context? And then maybe let's think about it from the perspective of people who are living after the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. You know, why is it that we today don't need to engage in the sacrificial system in order to be in the presence of God?
Yeah. In terms of part of the logic of the book of Leviticus is that on their own, humans again cannot dwell with God, but there actually needs to be some sort of transformation made that makes God's presence able to be with them. But just remember that within the context of the story Leviticus is trying to narrate, these things in that moment are conditional. God will bless you. You can have this land. You will have life in this land. You will be able to maintain blessings if these things are kept. And so one of those things is essentially eliminating the contagion of sin in one's midst. And so what that kind of came down to was, as a result of breaking legislation or as a result of breaking instruction, sacrifices were offered in order to maintain God's space with people. We never get the sense that these sacrifices were designed again to to atone for every sort of sin or problem the person would ever commit, but it's all kind of retroactive. And so all of this kind of, again, just like with the clean and unclean legislation, what this is designed to do is to walk the reader through and develop this conception of who God is and what he essentially requires. The sacrificial instructions of the first seven chapters of Leviticus, like the rest of the legislation in Leviticus and the legislation in the book of Exodus and the book of Numbers, is excerpted and collated from probably a much larger list of instructions. Hmm. And here's like some evidence for that. It's just that the Pentateuch, in traditional rabbinic Judaism, you get different debates on how many laws are in the Pentateuch, or how many laws are in the book of Moses or the Torah. And you get different debates. There's different counts. The two main counts is 611 and 613. 613, if we take the opening words of the Decalogue to be instructions. So most would say 611. Why is this relevant, or why would we even talk about this? The point is 611 is like the numerical value of just the word Torah. Hmm. So spelled in Hebrew, Tav, Vav, Resh, He, Torah. And so every word in Hebrew, every letter in Hebrew has a numerical value. And that's this. People take this to do weird stuff and just count and see what verses say that there's COVID's going to take place in 2020. Not doing weird stuff like that, but this is actually like legitimately an ancient scribal technique. And it's the same in the book of Proverbs. Book of Proverbs starts off and says, Mishle Shlomo, these are the Proverbs of Solomon. And the name Shlomo, its numerical value of those letters is 375, the same amount of Proverbs we have within the book of Proverbs. So you even get the sense too, as you read through Leviticus, that these laws are not comprehensive. There's a lot that kind of seems like it's left through the gaps. Mm. So in one ways, it seems to read very holistically. It applies to tons of areas of life. But on the other hand, you read through the sacrificial legislation and you're like, what are the other stuff I need to do? What kind of knife should I use? What about this? And what time should I do this? And like all this sort of stuff, which is just omitted. We just don't have that sort of stuff. And so even, again, rabbinic Judaism developed a tradition and holds that at Sinai, God also revealed an oral Torah to Moses that wasn't textualized. It was eventually brought down then through the rabbis and textualized at a much later period in the Mishnah or the Talmud. So the point here just being that it seems as though within the composition of the Pentateuch, certain laws were actually designed and textualized to tell a story. And so thus what we're reading right now isn't a pure law book, so to speak, but a book that has laws and legislation in it.
Yeah, so that's all fascinating. So if I'm hearing you correctly, Andrew, you're saying whereas Leviticus was certainly not written to, certainly not written to me and to you in 2023 in a completely different kind of context in all sorts of ways, there's an extent to which it was written to an audience almost sort of aside from the people who would be enacting these laws. So it's not just, oh, if you happen to be a priest, then this is your instruction book, kind of grab it and go. But that actually it's designed to be something that is actually more for those, or at least in addition for those who are not going to be enacting these laws themselves, but may be kind of a little bit on the outside looking in and trying to understand more of who God is and how we relate to him through that. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, that is a fair summary. And I think one of the things that kind of make this clear is that even internal to the book of Leviticus, you know, and we might talk about this towards the end of our conversation, Leviticus 26 presents a bunch of curses if you don't do these things. So as you're going to enter the land, this is what you should do, like hold to these practices. But in the instance that you don't, curses will come upon you. You're going to be exiled and carried off to another land. And then at the end, it says, just a possibility. It's like, that will happen. You actually won't be able to do this. And in light of that, you're going to be brought into exile. But it'll be because of God's faithful promises to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. Again, not the promises made at the covenant of Sinai, say, if you do these things, you get life. But because of the promises made to the patriarchs, I will bring you back and I will take care of you. And this is the same sort of image that we get at the end of the Pentateuch in Deuteronomy 28, where we get the covenant curses again. If you do these things, so Deuteronomus, the second iteration of the law, Moses' exposition of the law that you just read, by the end of it, he says, if you do these things, you will be able to inherit the land. But in the case that you don't, you're going to be kicked out. And at the end, he says, but you actually won't be able to do it. Hmm. And in turn, you're actually what you need. It says one day when all these curses, he says, when all these curses come upon you, you will be in a land that's not yours. And God will stir a work in your heart to bring you back. And it says, and God will cut your hearts back. The language is confusing to us as, you know, modern readers, but it's a sense that there's a hard heart that needs to be sliced open and needs to be a heart of flesh. And what that sort of indicates is the way in which God is bringing people who are naturally hardened to him, to himself, based on his work and not necessarily human fidelity to legislation.
That's a perfect bridge to helping us to understand this book from a New Testament perspective. So if I'm understanding you correctly, Andrew, you're saying even within the text of Leviticus itself, we get clued in to the fact that this isn't finally where God's work is ending, that actually God knows that his people will fail and that he has another solution. So help us to understand, in the light of Jesus's life, death, and resurrection, how should we now, if we're followers of Jesus, sort of see Leviticus, and especially maybe how should we or should we not understand the sacrificial system in light of Jesus's death and resurrection?
Yeah. According to the New Testament's own conception of things, the New Testament doesn't really feel like, or the authors of the New Testament don't really feel like they need to present some sort of new rationale or some sort of new reading onto these texts in order to make sense of the person and work of Jesus of Nazareth. According to them, the way that they conceive of things is that they can't help but only illustrate by means of the Pentateuch and by means of the prophets and by means of the writings that Jesus, who's the unknown figure, is the Christ, who's the known figure. So the Christ is the one people know about. He's the one the prophets refer to. He's the one that the Pentateuch describes. But for the New Testament, they, especially the gospel authors, take a person like John. He says, Jesus did a whole bunch more things than what I recorded in this book. He says, even if I were to record everything, they'd fill up like all the books in the world. But I chose this set to illustrate my point, just like Leviticus choosing its set of ideas to present the point that it's trying to present. John says, I chose these things so that you would know that the Christ is Jesus. The Christ who you should know about is the Jesus you don't know about. So essentially the way the New Testament reads, say, a book like Leviticus, if we want to like talk about like the book of Hebrews, for example, it reads Leviticus as on its own, already pointing to some sort of other need. It doesn't feel like it's not claiming some sort of unique inspiration 2.0 that can be overlaid on old texts and now we really know what they mean. Instead of citing the words of Christ, it chooses to cite the words of Leviticus to make sense of what Christ's sacrifice really meant.
Who Jesus is, It's interesting you brought up John's gospel. I've been reading through John's gospel with my kids, and one of the delightful things that we see in John's gospel is how Jesus is presented as, you know, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. So the sacrifice, but also then presents himself as the temple when he says, stands in the temple and says, destroy this temple and I will raise it up in 3 days. And his hearers are completely confused. Well, how, you know, this has taken 46 years to build. How are you going to raise it up in 3 days? And we hear that Jesus is talking about the temple of his body. And it's really fun sort of explaining to my children, oh, you know, Jesus is the sacrifice. Jesus is also the temple. Jesus is also the priest. Like this whole thing is fulfilled in Jesus, who is the great high priest who has made the real sacrifice. And so actually none of this is stuff that we now have to do, but all of us, as we read Leviticus, if we are followers of Jesus, can kind of see in different ways the ways that it kind of points us toward the ultimate fulfillment of the sacrificial system. I'm curious, Andrew, so just to maybe wrap up our time, I'd love for listeners to get a sense of you personally and kind of how you became a follower of Jesus. I know that you're somebody who approaches these biblical texts not just as as kind of an academic studying for a PhD, but actually also somebody who truly loves the Lord. So I'd love for people to get a sense of your own background and how you became a follower of Jesus.
Yeah, I grew up within the setting of a family that really prioritized what it meant to read God's word every day and every night together. And when I was little, I remember maybe I wasn't even above the age of 6, and we were reading Romans 5 one night, and I asked my dad, you know, if God knew humans would be so sinful, why would he create them in the first place? Hmm. Isn't that just, that's something that didn't really sit well with me, even as a near 6-year-old. And so, I mean, for a long time, I was always just curious about those sorts of questions and those sorts of things. It wasn't until I was in fifth grade where I kind of realized what it meant to actually be broken, what it meant to be sinful, and what it actually means then to have some sort of righteous covering for you. Mm-hmm. I understood the extent to which my disobedience, even just as like an 11 or 12-year-old, distanced me from a God who's holy. And I couldn't explain it that well at the time. That's all I kind of knew. It's just I had the sense that I'm not good enough on my own, and there actually needs to be something else.
Thanks so much, Andrew. If you'd like to think more about what we can learn from Leviticus, I highly recommend you read the New Testament book of Hebrews, which helps us to see how Jesus is the true priest who makes the real sacrifice for sin. You've been listening to the Confronting Christianity podcast. You can follow us on Twitter or Instagram, or you can leave us a review on iTunes. You can also include a question you'd like to see explored in a future episode, and we'll take that into consideration. Please join me next week when I'll be talking with a friend about how he became a Christian when he was an undergraduate, how he then went through an intense period of doubt, and how we can work through doubt and find connection. Until then.